Labia lies a whole lot of misinformation. Apparently, the internet has decided not only what women should look like physically and in their face, but also in their vulva. They should be small, symmetric, silent, pink, pretty, unaffected by age. But what's really impressive is that this is not medically true, and there's a lot of nuance to it. And today, we're going to get down and dirty between two labia with Dr. Dahlia Rice. Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Selena Rahman. I'm an OBGYN sexual medicine and menopause specialist here down in Chicago. You guys know me as Gyno Girl. And that's my podcast, Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. And we are doing an in-person podcast between two labia so that you guys can get all the good stuff and information in person with the amazing Dr. Dahlia Rice, friend, colleague, and local Chicagoan. We're going to talk about labiaplasties. We're going to talk about cosmetic oncology. We're going to talk about my tourism and midlife upgrades. And so, Dr. Dahlia Rice, welcome to Between Two Labia.
Thank you so much for having me, Between Two Labia.
I'm Dr. Dahlia Rice. I'm a certified plastic surgeon. I did my training in Rochester, New York, and general surgery training at Michigan State University. I opened up my own practice here in Chicago, DMR Aesthetics, almost 2 years ago now. I'm an awful lovely Dr. Lamont, and we've been great friends ever since.
You're so
very close.
Very close here. Yeah, I'm between two her labor. She can find me between her and labia doing her path.
And then I can look at her neck at the thing.
Yes. Watch out. You know what? When you're friends with the plastic surgeon, they're always looking at how they can make me prettier.
Well, someone can take one for the team so everyone can look down forever.
Right. So that's what exactly happens when I'm checking out her genital urinary syndrome, menopause, and pap smears.
We like, talk about all the things.
She's like, hey, you know what? I got something for your neck.
That's right. You don't want to leave you here.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, you noticed?
The four signs of aging. We all, we're getting in the thick of it.
We're getting in the thick of it. No, but it is. Can we talk about that for a second? Yeah. Actually, because I feel like, you know, at a certain point when you hit midlife, things are really going well. And then all of a sudden, one day you'll wake up and you're
literally,
like, wait, I never noticed that on my neck before. Where did that come from? It's almost like you fall off
overnight.
Like literally.
All of a sudden you wake up and you're like, I don't recognize this face anymore.
Yes.
Or what is going on with my neck all of a sudden? Like, where did the, what is this? Like, what happened here?
I mean, it's true because I did her pap last year and she made no comment. So it literally happened within a year.
Girl, because I'm looking in the mirror myself seeing the same thing.
You didn't say this last year. She's like, well, I was looking, so it must have changed.
You know, that's the blessing and curse of being a plastic surgeon.
Yeah.
You see so many things, but same probably for you.
People
asking all kinds of stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, girls for sure, I learned about fibroids and labias and flavias and all the things.
Between two labia.
And so, you know, that's really an upshot for me. I mean, obviously, we all want to feel our best and look our best. And it doesn't have to always be plastic surgeon or surgery or Botox or whatever, but it's what you feel like would bring you to the next level, right? We're in midlife, like people are really experiencing ups and downs from hormonal changes, from social changes, right? People are getting married, divorced, reconnected. They're getting losing parents. All things are happening to women in midlife, and so a lot of stress. So, as you know, as a menopause and sexual medicine specialist, I'm really working on maximizing your health span. But part of that, I think, is really understanding like how to make yourself for the better. And many times that is looking toward plastic surgery or procedures, potentially, right? Sometimes we've maxed out, you know, diet, exercise, sleep, all the things, you know, good facial products.
And then skin changes so significantly during these times. It could be, especially with the hormonal swings and perimenopause, sometimes your skin is, you know, oily, other times it's dry. It's like, you really got to be checking in to kind of reassess, like, what your skincare regimen is, what you're doing. And again, like, you know, aging gracefully is great, but also, like, you can age also not gracefully in the fact that you want to just, like, get after it. And that's okay, too, because it's a functional thing. At that point, you want to look on the outside how your family is.
That's how exactly it. And I feel like, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about labiaplasties because we know that
the number of labiaplasties in the United States, some lives, probably worldwide, but specifically here, that people are really, you know, we talk about in the menopause space a lot that your labia and mora start to disappear because of like the hormone changes.
Right.
And so, you know, that's, you know, labiaplasty, that wasn't me. But it just all of a sudden, sometimes women wake up with their lichen sclerosis or other things, and their labia gets resorbed into the labia majora. And that is a function of hormones. That's a function of inflammatory skin conditions. But there are many women who go through weight changes. They have pregnancies. They're born with really elongated labia, and it becomes a real problem. Can we talk about how you approach these patients that come to you? Because, you know, in my training, if you didn't learn as much labiaplasties, but I've done them, I trained with someone back in California. So I used to do more of them when people have functional issues.
Right.
And so I know kind of like how I used to approach them, but I think it's different. You know, we approach things differently as gynecologists, plastic surgeons. And you know, it used to be a taboo thing in the gynecology space. Like, what? You're not supposed to touch your labia. You're not supposed to do that. Like, all labias are normal, blah, blah, blah. I mean, and that's up to a point. We want to normalize the variety of labias out there. But there are definitely women that, you know, like, their labia gets stuck in their vagina. Like, mm-hmm. There are people who can't wear jeans because of the elongated labia minora. There are people who have pain, right?
Like, so walk me through when we see a patient for a labia pop.
You're absolutely right. Sometimes it's not cosmetic. Sometimes it's biting. Literally, like,
yeah.
You know, these patients come in, you know, what is normal anatomy for the vulvar region? I mean, it's based on whatever has been told for us for the last 200 years, based on cadaver studies, based on, you know, what they mean. That's exactly it. And not only that, in the modern day, you know, it's all about like, remove all the hair, get all the spotlights on there. Let's see this in HD. Next thing you know, you're like, whoa, okay, what is normal, what's not? And a lot of the shifts that we see in the field are primarily driven by the porn industry, social media, kind of just in our world now, people are so much more aware of their bodies, yes, and how they appear on screen, right?
Absolutely.
And so that's like a big driver of these things, because people will come in and think, oh, well, I want to look normal. And what is that? What is that exactly? And
right.
Each person is super different. So the majority of this is primarily going to be functional.
So basically, like, you know, when we're talking about labiaplasties, the function is just as important as costhesis.
And, you know, what is the cosmetic outcome ultimately become? And when people come in to see me, you know, I ask them very clearly, like, what are you looking for exactly?
Yeah.
Like, what style do you want? You know, and then to remind them that things are going to continue to change as you age. So we don't want to be so aggressive and trade one problem for another problem. And for later in life, you know, end up in a situation where we took a little too much off the top.
Yeah.
And then next time, you know, can't get that back. You know, or it's very complicated to get that back.
Right.
And so really a lot of these patients are looking to be more comfortable, looking to feel more confident in themselves. Because as the laxity happens during the aging process, that does not isolate to the face, but different areas of the body. It includes the vulva, right? And so that really can be very challenging for women. So we're seeing a lot more of labiaplasty, but also fat transfer to labia majora to kind of add more volume into these areas, because look, fat pads are losing volume everywhere. So
let's talk about it. There was a trending article about, you know, because Ozempic gets blamed for everything, but it's really just, you know, like, it's a great drug. GLP-1s are amazing drugs for so many people. But there was a trending article recently about the Ozempic labia the vulva or whatever.
Right.
And at this, obviously, when you lose weight in one area, you lose weight in all areas. Sometimes you lose weight in too aggressively. We always say sometimes you have to choose between your ass and your face, right?
That's right. Why can't you have both now?
Okay, you know,
let's just move from one place to the other.
Yeah.
We've gotten so much better at those things. But again, like, what is driving those?
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, the youthfulness, the kind of concept of, like, you know, you get these deflation aspects that are happening, and these patients want to regain that because they don't feel like that on the inside. They want to still get very active sexual lives. They still want to be able to function in their world and be very confident, especially in today's day and age where, you know, 50% of, you know, marriages end in divorce. So
people are re-entering this world in a midlife phase.
See?
And so when they're looking ahead about like, okay, what do I want this to be like? Or how do I feel when I'm in a situation where I am I confident with my own anatomy? And I think a lot of this, again, comes down to the fact that, you know, it's stigmatized so heavily still, you know? It's as if it's okay for, you know, us to be able to make a big deal about our faces and that we're doing all the skincare and all the face.
Yeah.
But how dare you want a pretty vagina?
Yeah, where dare you? Exactly. Yes. And it's, you know, as a gynecologist, you know, women are always apologizing to me. Like, I'm sorry I didn't shave. I'm sorry that, you know, I'm bleeding too much. Like, don't.
Yeah.
Don't apologize.
Why are you hiding your underwear?
Yeah, exactly. That's for the best doctor.
Right.
Why I hide underwear when I see my guy.
Literally.
But it's true. And I think that, like, it's very, it's challenging enough, right, to age and age gracefully. And I find that, like, you know, if that's what makes you feel better, some people use makeup, some people use Botox, some people use a little bit of plastic surgery, right? And so,
yeah,
I think that that is all within, you know, what you're, how can we great age the way you want to, but also, like, feel comfortable and have love.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, again, not making apologies for wanting things to be the way you want them to be or how you perceive that.
Right.
And again, you know, this also comes down to hyperpigmentation that happens or darken, right? Doesn't matter what culture you come from. It doesn't matter your background, ethnicity, any of those things. Like, we all have variations of pink and dark discolorations. We all have variations in our anatomy. 50% of labia are asymmetric.
Yes.
And so, you know, this is real. And then, but what we tell everybody or what the signal is out there in the world is that's not normal. Symmetry is natural, right? And beautiful.
Right. That's what,
which symmetry is not normal.
Yeah,
that's less likely, but, you know, as a plastic surgeon, symmetry is, like, what we aim for, of course. And again, setting those expectations for people, right? Like, I can't make somebody with, like, a heavy, dense labia have a lighter, thinner tissue. Like, I can't change the tissues. But what I can do is help them feel more confident in it so that when they're functioning in the world, they're not having it caught in underwear and they're able to bike and horse that, right? And do all the things. And even something as basic as wearing Fox, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, that can be a problem for patients. But then we also have an aesthetic aspect because that's important, too. And so wanting them to really be happy for what they want their body to look like. So I often ask patients, like, how heavy of a, you know, what are we talking about? Like, where do you want? Like, do you have a wish pick? So I ask people a lot, like, show me the wall of labia that you want, you know, so I can kind of get a sense of, like, what the level is. And when they're showing me something super aggressive, I will talk them off the ledge. I'm like, you don't want to go this aggressive because if you do that, you can't go back. Like, I can always take a little bit more, but I can't add more. So just really kind of setting those expectations of, like, you may not look like that famous porn star that you want. But we can get you kind of close if you want.
Right.
But again, the native tissues, not only going to be able to change, like, the heaviness of those
networks. Right. And, you know, as a sex med specialist, we always want to be cognizant of the fact that the clitoris that you're seeing, the glands, is just really the tip of the iceberg. But so much of the clitoral engorgement tissue sits behind the leading door.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going too deep, and this is why Dr. Rice doesn't like to do really aggressive ones, because you can damage the nerves that are feeding the clitoris.
Absolutely.
And your orgasm function doesn't usually get.
It goes in there now.
Right.
That's, like, the most feared complication.
Yeah.
That's obviously necrosis, you know, it's just getting the blood vessels during those. So, you know, again, getting really aggressive about things, ruining the blood supply, nerve damage, like, literally, like, you want it to look better, but at what cost, you know? And so there's always a balancing act there.
Yeah.
And I think most patients setting that expectation of safety plus function and cosmesis, there's a nice balance there.
You have to be balanced.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Because that's what sometimes I'll see also in the sex med field is that someone's gotten too aggressive and had a too aggressive of a labiaplasty. And all of a sudden, their labia minora are so kind of, like, trimmed. And then they got some pleural hood issues happening, reduction around that, and that they get some damage to those nerves. So I think it's very, very important to find someone that is well aware of the anatomy, that clitoral arousal tissue sits right behind the labia minora, you know?
Yeah.
And so we really want to be, and that's why that when you're sexually aroused, the labia become very, you know, they become enlarged and all the blood is flowing into the labia because that's what clitoral engorgement tissue.
right? So that's really important to remember when you have, when you're thinking about this kind of procedure.
Absolutely. And I think that you could definitely hit the nail on the head in the fact that, you know, really focusing on someone who understands the anatomy, people who are specialists in this, you know, the vulvar and vagina are sort of the wild, become the new wild, wild west, in like the wellness industry, right?
Yeah.
It's just some of that, you know, you end up seeing a lot of people who are doing procedures that are either too aggressive or they don't really fully understand how to handle tissues properly or they don't understand the anatomy. And that's when you run into problems because it actually, you know, when you're learning these techniques, it is very easy to be too aggressive. That is so easy to do.
Yeah.
And you don't really appreciate that until you've seen the bad stuff.
Because that tissue retracts, right? You take some of that lighting, you lower it, starts, it'll retract right up in that
every hour.
You have to also remember that this is a, you're sitting on your, everyday. Yes. So the recovery is not mine.
No.
Even though the procedure is like, maybe an hour and a
half. Yes. Or in the office,
in the office.
Muscle.
Yeah.
Sounds so easy.
Yeah.
The reality is the swelling that happens afterwards, like, it's like a beat. Looks like something from Stranger Things. It's just so swollen.
Yeah.
Just like, just looks, and so being able to continue to, as a surgeon, look at the anatomy and being able to understand how that transitions, even with all the swelling.
Yes.
The time of surgery to over reset. And then afterwards to tell patients, like, this is totally normal.
Yeah.
It's going to look a little.
Don't flip down here for 2 days.
Yeah, it's going to look a little like Frankenpussy.
Yeah.
Like, let's just move on. It'll be okay. I promise. Like, after a couple weeks,
it's
going to look normal.
Yeah.
In a recovery, that area is a privilege here.
Yeah.
It recovers so fast from things. Like, think about the job profile.
Yeah.
The recovery that happens, like the mucosa recovers so fast. And so, recognizing that and also recognizing any problems that can arise during the
process. Super. You do have to be kind of like in a place of not going to be walking around much the first few
days. You got to really keep your pelvis up for like a solid week or two.
Yes.
I tell patients all the time, like, get those hips up, girl.
Yeah.
Ice.
Yeah,
like lots of ice.
Sense a little bit. Well, let's talk a little bit about what we were talking about before, the fat transfer. Like, I feel like that's trending a lot too.
And it is.
We talk about this Ozempic, how does that procedure, like, how do you go about doing it? What is the process?
Yeah, good question. Because there's usually two different ways. You can either use your own fat, and now they have a new product on the market that we can use a cadaver fat, actually, that they've isolated. So, one of the biggest downfalls for using your own fat is sometimes it's very much based on the person's biology. Like, if you're older, your fat take is not going to be as good. If you're, chronic medical issues, like whatever reason, there could be all kinds of reasons why you can have good take or not take.
Yeah.
Technique is a huge component to this. So a lot of times when we're doing any fat transfer, whether it be a face, the labia, the breast, the buttocks, like all those things, you really want to make sure you're handling the tissue in a way that is not going to damage those cells.
Oh.
So actually we harvest the fat by hand and then process that. Really in the labia, it is no different than your actual lips, right?
Yep.
You know, you want the fat to be very mild and thin and so that you can really kind of get that to kind of feather out so it looks very natural, but you can't put pressure on the area. Like, you really got to lay low for 6 weeks because that is really the time frame where all those fat cells need to set up shop because it's the stem cells in there that are going to kind of be there and sort of drive that process.
Yeah.
There's usually some touch-ups involved afterward, but a lot of times that's pretty mild and all this stuff can be done in the office under local. Again, even facial fat transfer, we're doing a lot of that. So it really kind of goes hand in hand with that because, when you're looking at things and you're doing surgery, it's kind of like doing a labiaplasty, like a trim procedure without a clitoral foot reduction.
Yeah.
Like, it sort of looks like the face doesn't match the neck, you know what I mean, kind of thing? But, like, you can't do one without the other one.
Yeah.
So it looks a little bit unfinished.
Yeah.
Or it kind of has, like, this look of, like, there's something missing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So a lot of times patients will want labiaplasties, then they recognize that also their labia majora are also deflated. And so now, how aggressive do you become on labiaplasty in order to accommodate for the deflation that's happening of the labia majora as well
from age and weight loss?
Correct.
Yeah. So is that, are you seeing more than that?
Yes.
Losing weight from, these for medications that are built.
For sure. And a lot of it is just, we're talking about it now, right? Like, we have had enough more advances in our field where we're becoming more, like, open about talking about these things. Like, because 15, 20 years ago, my parents were talking about that. Like, my grandfather wasn't talking about those things.
Yeah.
And, like, that wasn't even a thought in their minds or just
to discuss with that blood, right? You know, and gone are the days where we've left the kind of the husband stitch, and now we're moving on to like more female focused of how what they want, how it looks, and also comfort, right? Because if you have deflated, you know, if you have deflated Mons, you have deflated labia majora, then sometimes even just sitting on that area is uncomfortable, right? And so regaining some of the padding can make a big difference for people as well.
Oh, so interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for example. Yes, because it's all bony. You don't have any more like padding, right? Yeah. Like everywhere else. And so you put a lot of pressure on that area, especially if you do biking, horseback riding, like any kind of thing, really.
Yeah.
You know, that can make a big difference for patients.
So are you seeing, you see a lot of revision side people, you know, we were talking offline about the show that used to, is it still on? Called Bosch?
I think it's still on.
Okay. There used to be a plastic, a show that was done by a couple of plastic surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Bosch, which, you know, kind of relates to people that have had surgery that didn't see to go the way it should.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this comes down to, again, like knowing what's wrong and what's not. Because some people have had, you know, pretty aggressive labiaplasties, but then they don't know where to turn to get the corrected.
Right.
And it's very interesting because one of the things that I've also seen a lot of too is our transgender population.
Yeah.
We also have issues with that where they don't have anybody to really do revisions. They're not quite sure what to do. Like they're kind of like, okay, great. You know, now this is where you're at and you should be happy and go on in your life. And I think that, you know, again, this all comes down to gender affirming care, right? Because that is teaching us, okay, well, we can fix these things. There is a way to like correct something.
Yeah.
It is hard sometimes, depending on what level of it. But you know, as plastic surgeons, we make something from nothing all the time. So for us, like, it's not uncommon that we use local flaps or whatever. So a lot of times, if there hasn't been a, you know, really aggressive clitoral hood reduction, we can actually use a clitoral. Use that clitoral hood skin to actually create labia minora, that to give more length to it if there's any kind of like aggressive trim that is happening. So, you know, kind of creating something and using stitching techniques to be able to kind of create those columns. Yeah. And so that's where that three-dimensional like spatial understanding is and how you can take something and make it what you want it to be, because at the end of the day, it really is just inefficient, right?
Mm, that's so true.
Mm-hmm.
It's so interesting because I think that, you know, a plastic surgeon really has to be really an artistic kind of mindset, right? You want to kind of go, what actually, you didn't talk about your origin story. What brought you into plastics?
Yeah, so actually, this is my second career. Because when I first started, I was teaching human anatomy and human dissection classes when I was in my early 20s. My sort of was not quite sure where I wanted to go from there. I took a job doing autopsies. And it was really that time where I really like leaned in the anatomy that I enjoyed. And so coming into medical school, I thought I wanted to do forensics. And then when I got further into it, I started talking to people. And I recognize, like, I like doing a lot of different things. And I like really thinking outside the box.
Yeah.
Or figuring out how we can affect something, you know, make it better for the patient.
Yeah.
And in a lot of the surgical fields, it's very much like if you do something off the cuff, people are like, what are they doing?
Yeah.
But in plastic surgery, like, creativity is actually, like, celebrate. You know, that's how we learn all these procedures. And it's so interesting because as a field, we're some of the youngest, we're the youngest subspecialty.
Yeah,
it's only been around since the 1940s as a board certification, right? And but yet you think about plastic surgery and that's been happening since, you know, the hundreds BC, right? You know, we were doing forehead flaps for patients that were getting their nose cut off for that. So to me, like the history of it, the being able to operate on every single part of the body, you know, take care of myself and take care of many, and really ultimately, like, my patients are happy, right?
Yeah.
Like, I love making people happy.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people sometimes, like, I'm not saving lives, I'm saving breasts, so, you know, whatever you want to say. But that really makes a big difference in people's world, you know? And for me, it's like, I love the idea of them being excited and happy and being able to operate everywhere and also, you know, taking something from nothing. Like, that was cool because you can really think of stuff and that can be really innovative and be impactful. And what your neighbor is doing can be completely different from what you're doing. And that's okay too.
Yeah. No, because you can actually figure out where you want to sort of carve out.
Yep.
What your, I guess, niche is in some ways.
Yeah. And their skincare. And as a woman, you know, who's going through the whole process of everything, like, we're always constantly in that phase. And so for me, like, I've always had really bad skin my whole life. So for me, like, I really enjoyed, like, learning about that. But kind of the concept, again, of like taking something from nothing to make it something that's functional and has form to it was just like, ugh, This is it.
That's amazing. Yeah. And yeah, I think it's just like anything else. It's a calling.
That's right.
Right. But it's a very male dominated field.
That's right. There's only, currently there's about 20% of plastic surgeons that are female, which is a little over 1,400 of us actually in the United States that are female board certified plastic surgeons. So despite the fact that over 90% of our patients are females, we are still considered a pretty heavy female surgical field, even though we're still a minority in the field.
Yeah, one of my best friends is a plastic surgeon in California, as Dr. Azra Ashraf, who I've interviewed for. But I remember because she was a resident at the same time that I was a resident, so I would see the kind of stuff that she went through.
Oh my gosh.
Like, I'm sure you have stories to tell.
Terrible.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, I think the patriarchy runs deep in a lot of these areas.
It's a good old boys' club.
It's a good old boys' club. You know, I mean, you can't get your jobs afterwards, all these challenges that, you know, like you find, you know.
Yes. And that's why a lot of female plastic surgeons leave academia. They leave, you know, kind of careers where, you know, it seems on the outside that this would actually be a really good position for people to climb up the academic ladder, which has consistently shown, even, you know, based on we're getting paid less than men are, we are oftentimes overlooked for promotions. And so it really kind of pushes a lot of the women out. And, you know, from my standpoint, you know, I was in a very rural area in Wisconsin before I opened up my own practice. And I really kind of felt a lot of that. You know, it wasn't even passively, right? Yeah. It was like actually like pretty active.
Yeah.
And for me, I was like, I can't live a life where I'm always kind of, you know, second class citizen because I'm a woman who's a surgeon.
Yeah.
Yet all the patients, you know, wanted, right? Because a woman's going to want a woman's, you know.
Yeah. Right.
Thoughts and ideas, and I listen to my patients, right. And I'm like, okay, well, what fits your anatomy? What fits
as a person? Not all.
No,
plastic surgeons are like this, but obviously, there's, you know, some that probably just tell patients what they think that they should get.
And you know, and if that's what a patient wants, that's fine too, right? Because you know, everyone's focus might not know, and they also may not, you know, maybe for them that's important to them is to have a male opinion about that.
Yeah,
and other women, it might be important for them to have a female opinion about that. And I think the best thing is just really what I tell my patients is to try, you know, check out multiple doctors and see who resonates the best with you, because fit is super important. You know, because again, just like anything else, like I have to figure out who to operate on, who not to operate on.
Yeah.
And they also have to figure out who is the best surgeon for them. So that, you know, when things happen, somebody's there for them and they really trust that person through this process.
And just tell me a little bit how you go about, like, there, you know, you see these pictures that go around and it's like someone has had so much excessive surgery or so much excessive filler or Botox or whatever. Like, how do you as a plastic surgeon say, you know what, enough is enough? Like,
yeah. It's a delicate balance because, like, one, I'm not here to yuck anyone's yum.
Yeah.
Because that's your aesthetic. By all means, that's okay too.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why we have so many options in aesthetic, and that's why we have so many options for surgeons. But I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, again, asking them, like, what's driving their forces, right?
Right.
What is it that they're looking for?
Right.
Like, are you trying to change something because, you know, because of emotional reasons? Or is it truly something that is driving you because you have thought about it a lot? Yes, exactly. And again, it's the dysmorphia is so common because we are taught from such a young age as women that we should look a certain way. You're too fat. No, you're too skinny now. No, it's
not strong enough.
Now you're not strong enough. Yeah. Now you're too thin. Yeah. Now it's just like next time we turn, every time we turn the corner, it's at another trend that it's like big, small,
big, like that Barbie monologue, right?
Yes.
So hard to be a woman.
It really is. And so you have to ask, you know, okay, is this person emotionally healthy to go through the process of surgery? Not even necessarily from a surgical standpoint, but post-operative stuff. If a complication happens, if they're going to shut down and not communicate with me, even in the pre-operative point, what's going to happen when they have complications?
Yeah.
They're not going to, it's not going to go well, right? Because they're just going to shut down. They're going to have a hard time going through that.
Yeah.
And I think, again, there's a delicate balance between telling someone like, hey, you look like you're becoming alienized.
Yeah.
You know, that we're trending away from that normal versus what normal is. And, you know, I'm not the person that likes to be kind of so direct and say like, you look crazy, right?
Yeah.
Because that's not fair to anybody to say.
Right.
I'm not here to judge your what you've done. Yeah, exactly. All I'm here to do is guide you what my aesthetic is and what I prefer and also like how that matches with their anatomy. You know, is that so for me, like, again, focusing on more natural aesthetics, you know, how to get there, because sometimes people get to a point where they like have lost themselves in the process, right? Like, where's your identity at this point, you know? Yeah. And so sometimes you can see that in people. It becomes obvious when you spend the time to talk to patients, like, who's in the right headspace for surgery and who's not, you know?
And I think a lot of people that have that issue usually come to it and they're like, wait, what did that, you know?
Yeah, because they'll wake up on their own and like, just like how we wake up and we're like, what the hell happened to our neck?
Yeah.
Like they'll wake up one day and be like, wow, like what happened? I don't look like myself anymore.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's a process that is deeply personal and they have to go through that themselves. Because again, you know, that is just going to put a bad taste in their mouth or make them feel even worse if I'm like, oh my gosh, you look crazy, right?
Right.
You know, versus like, hey, you know, have you, you know, what are the things that are bothering you? Let's talk about that. And then we can kind of just like guide them gently from there about like how that interacts, how one spot interacts with another spot on the body and
how that mobility sounds
throughout your mass.
And that's really important too, because everyone lives so differently. They score so differently.
Yes.
Anatomy, pigmentation, genetics,
already pro-inflammatory patients, like all the reasons that patients will sometimes just not heal properly cannot necessarily be even just because of their diet and exercise. It can be very much a genetic,
right?
Right.
Absolutely. Which actually brings me to another thing that I had been thinking about. And that was, you know, in the last 2 years, I've gone to couple different conferences and I've traveled to different areas. So last year with Janeiro de Janeiro in Brazil, and it was for this World Sexual Medicine Conference, which was amazing. And every corner there was, you know, Botox, plastic surgery, you know, lipo and Volt, which, you know, Brazil is really known for a lot of this plastic surgeries and all things. And this summer, I'm out of Turkey. And, you know, it's always a joke about, you know, you tell people that they got their hair transplants and they're all on trips. I've just seen them in these little groups. And so medical tourism is huge right now.
Huge. I mean, it's been on the rise. And again, I think that this comes down to like why you start to be more driven to go to certain places, because it's not always valuable. It's cheaper to go there. A lot of it is could be aesthetic. Could be also, you know, like what are the things that they're looking for? But also, you know, I think that there is some concept of like, oh, it is cheaper to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I think we struggle in the U.S. is that we have very extensive training programs. You know, we are costly because our staff is more costly. Everything we do is more costly in the United States.
Yeah.
And in general, people in the United States have less plastic surgery than everywhere else in the world. Like Korea, it's South America, like, but it's also perceived very different. You know, it's still a little taboo here. It's still more conservative. Yeah. Like there, they focus on, you know, if you don't like something, then change it.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I think with medical tourism, it can be a slippery slope because you think it sounds so like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to go have this procedure done. I'll be home in a couple of weeks. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
And then you run into problems. And then no one wants to touch you. And everybody wants to charge cash for things because you've paid all the amount for your surgery, plus your post-operative care in that.
Yeah.
And then now you're in a situation where, like, the emergency department doesn't want to touch you because they're worried about, you know, litigation as well. You know, because we're a high litigation country. So those are also important things, you know. And I think that a lot of this comes down to also access, right? Like, you talk about how when you go to Brazil, you see everything. Although we do see a lot of med spas and things like that here as well.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think that a lot of patients struggle with here and that drives them sometimes for medical tourism is suboptimal surgical candidates, right? We're very picky. You got to be very, like, there's certain criteria that you have to meet in order to have a safe surgery. Now, it's kind of the classic, like, well, smoking's bad for you. Well, then why did my grandfather, who was 90-something years old, smoke and never get lung cancer sort of situation?
Yeah,
right? It's not going to happen to me.
Yeah.
But the reality is that complications out there.
Yeah, and whatever.
To everyone.
If you operate enough, you have help.
That's right. You have zero complication rates. You know what they say? It's like you're either a liar or you don't operate.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
So everybody's going to have complications. And it can be something small or it can be big. But if you're coming out of a location where they operate on you, you know, and then you're coming to a place and you have a complication, like that's really where things kind of get a little bit difficult, because how does our system structurally support those patients, right? Because that's a cash basis and the insurance companies don't want to cover it. And I still have to pay my bills, right?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, that comes down to that. Like, I don't think there's any other, there's not a whole lot of fields in in our, like, in general in the United States, where people are like, this should work for free, right?
Yeah.
You know?
And that's only medicine.
We're shepherds of our service, and I agree with that.
Yeah.
But we also have to, you know, eat and feed on it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And I think with medical tourism, there is sort of, like, it's so glamorous, glamorized. Do you know what I mean?
It's people
sort
of stay, like, here and play.
Yes. Like, right. You know, come here to this luxury resort where you recover for, like, next to nothing.
Yeah.
And you go home and no big deal. You're kind of like, your dog will take out your drains, you know, all these things. And it sort of becomes sort of a handoff situation that's not always accurate. Now, there's plenty of people who've had medical tourism that have had great results.
Sure.
And again, I think this comes down to access too, right? Because, right, like, a lot of transgender surgeries were not happening in the United States. They had to go other places because they did not fit. Right?
Yeah.
And so some of it is that, and some of it is, like, what level of expertise, right?
Yeah.
When people are doing far more surgeries in a country than we are, they're going to inherently probably do a little bit better or in a different way that might resonate with that patient. Yeah. So again, like, I think medical tourism has become a really bad problem because it's not regulated.
Right.
We're regulated to death.
Yes.
But yet that's not regulated. You know, the wellness that you're not. Right, there's so many things that are not regulated,
supplements.
Well, right, that we catch a lot of the down, but then we catch a lot of the fallout from.
Yeah,
that, you know, these patients sift through the cracks, and then we're there to sort of kind of help with that process, which is great. But also, it also begs the question of, like, who's responsible for that?
Mm-hmm. That's something you have to be a little cautious of. Is that, you know, what happens when you come back and you have an issue, or what will happen if on the way to one's metric. And again, I'm sure there's plenty of people that have had great outcomes, I'm sure. And these surgeons are very good. But it is one of these things where if you come back, you know, you have to be able to access your surgeon for complications.
Absolutely.
And so if you can't do that, that's about
right. 100%.
And I think that, you know, speaking of medical tourism, like, what's happening in Korea, man? These guys.
Oh, my God. And they're like machines.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing, actually. Some of the stuff, with the products that they come out with. I have a lot of friends who we always joke about, and some of them are Korean, and let's just go and get everything.
Yeah, right? Well, because they're doing things that are, you know, again, our FDA process to get things approved is really wild, opposite person corrupt.
Yeah.
You know, and so in order for things to get approved here in the United States, it's got to go through much more stringent things. And then about litigation issues, right? Again, but really a lot of it too is, like, again, they do more class of surgery here.
Yeah.
I do here in the United States. And then also they focus more on prevention. It's discussed from a very early age that, you know, that they are going to start skincare and that they need to do sunscreen
from
a young age. And so, like, the concept of prevention rather than fixing the problem after it's already occurred, like, that is kind of, I think, the biggest, like, difference in our markets is the fact that, you know, in Korea and in South Korea, all the stuff there is more preventative or looking at low inflammatory stuff, right? When I look at Korean skincare products, when you look at that stuff, they focus a lot on how they can prevent things from happening and how they can keep things at a low inflammatory process, basically supporting the skin barrier, low inflammatory issues. Like, whereas in the United States, we're like, oh, fuck, I have all of them.
Good. I found my job.
Perfect. All of a sudden, like, we wake up and we're like, fuck, I gotta exfoliate my skin. Then you're like, oh, I gotta exfoliate every day now. You know?
Yeah.
So we kind of, like, take things to, like, super extreme. Let's do this guns of blaze.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, they're all about the slow and steady, consistent process that's gonna get you good results.
Yeah.
Because you've really maintained your process in your skincare and your listening to your skin. Whereas here, we're like, let's do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, genetics play a huge role.
Huge.
You know, I'm sure that if you've been doing this for generations, your skin is going to be inherently genetically, like, different.
Absolutely.
And so I think that, you know, we have to be cognizant of that, you know, that what happened was good for us, and, you know, good for them, and for us in different countries.
Yeah.
But I do know a lot of, you know, patients who want to go there and those, you know, the anatomical differences in certain cultures and how certain you might be a little better, you know, manage some of that, like surgeries around the eyes or surgeries in the face. But,
No, and I think that is absolutely accurate.
Mm-hmm.
When you're looking at things from, you know, from, like, you know, from ethnicity standpoint, like everybody's anatomy is a little bit different. And if you don't really truly understand that, or you don't really focus a lot on that population subset, have a lot, right, it's going to be really easy to, like, you know, when you're doing like a simple procedure, like a blepharoplasty, it's super easy. And when you're looking at Asian eyelids, to give them the wrong location of their crease, that consistently happens a lot. And so those are things that, you know, when you're looking at the anatomy, you've got to again ask yourself, like, what is this person's anatomy?
Yes.
And what is it that would look best on that? It's not about me doing what I think is best for them or the same procedure on every single person.
Right.
Because the numbers that we've, like, learned in our, you know, training are based on Caucasians, right? They're not really based on like a variation of ethnicities. And therefore, when you're looking at that, looking at surgeons, it's going to be super important to recognize that inherently you're going to have more consistent outcomes in, from a cultural standpoint, if you are able to, you're somebody who understands that.
Right. Because, you know, again, everyone feels differently. If you're someone that keloids a lot,
right?
You might not know that until your first procedure anyway, or for family history. But either way, it's like, you know, someone has to be aware of even the recovery.
Absolutely. Anyway, even just having conversations, this each culture communicates in different ways.
Yeah.
And especially when there's complications, right? Things like that. Like, you know, every culture is handled very differently. Especially in the United States, we're sort of like, you know, soft gloves on a lot of things. But at the end of the day, you know, I think everybody wants to be heard, but culturally, they may not understand what you're telling them or vice versa if you don't understand how they speak to each other.
Right,
or respect the fact that their culture, how they express things to you, make me differently feel like brazen and direct, where we are like, oh, our feelings are hurt, right?
Yeah,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? And so that's very different too.
Yeah.
And again, it's all about setting expectations. You know, in Korea, they're really great about setting expectations. Again, you know, here in the United States, a lot of it, you know, it becomes very service industry focused.
Sure.
Mentality, you know, I mean, that if customers always right, all those things, and yes, patients are always right in their feelings and all the stuff that's associated with that. You just have to be able to communicate with that in a way that they can understand.
Yeah, and still for knowing the limitations, what, you know, based on anatomical locations, all the things, right?
Really be able to explain
it
to each other in a way that, like, okay, we trust that you're gonna be there for them and understand what they're asking of you.
Yeah.
And then you can deliver that.
Yeah. So I think those are all important aspects to consider as well, Jim. So when looking for someone to help you navigate, you know, how you feel about yourself, your cosmetic journey, your aesthetic journey, all of things.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many layers and different things that are involved in that. I you know, again, you know, and nowadays, thankfully, we're more focused on, like, also not only just, like, changing stuff, but the quality of things, right? The quality of the skin care. And we're understanding skin so much better than we used to, right? Gone are the days where we use the apricot scrub from St. Ives where we would damage our skin, you know, and the harsh chemicals we would use to sort of get rid of acne and all these things.
Yeah.
You know, we're learning so much more about, like, what's healthy for our skin, what's important, and how to create a really overall look that you're looking for that kind of feels cohesive and natural in a way that's still, you know, honors the health of the skin.
Because I think that's sort of the trending way, right? Like, now I'm trying to be more toward natural skin.
Yes. Right. Focusing again.
Less fillers, more.
Right. More, you know, using as resurfacing, exactly. But also volume restructure with fat transfers to phase. Like, that's becoming a bigger thing now. You know, when fillers came out, that was like a huge hit in the market. Then we, you know, just like everything else, we overdo it in the United States. We're like, let's do all of this. And then now we're like, okay, let's come back and bring it back a little bit. So now we're kind of finding the happy balance between, like, you know, maybe this isn't the right thing for every single person, but at the end of the day, texture and tone of skin is going to be amazing for every patient, regardless of the procedure. And it can make you look younger just from a skincare standpoint.
Yeah.
You know, and people, again, like, taking those multi-modalities of looking at, okay, how can I make the skin healthier? How can I make this so that I can have great skin for the rest of my life, but then also still address the aging issues that are happening?
Mm-hmm.
So again, it comes down to prevention, right? And on the millennials, we're really kind of big drivers in that, right? We don't want big changes.
Right.
Same thing in Korea. I mean, you see that, like, they do small things early, right? They do a lot of stuff preventative early, have small changes. Whereas, you know, to say it's like, oh shit, okay, now we got to do this.
I mean, that's the whole issue with our medical system in general, right? Like,
we put on fires,
right? We're one of the ER, one of the urgent care, or not
doing the routine visits that we should be doing to think ahead. And that's
right.
Part of what we do in menopause world is, we're trying to get people to think about what's happening to your life after 40s, what's happening to your ages, what does this transition mean to be? And I think that's, should be the way that we approach everything.
Oh, for sure. And I think, again, as the United States solicitates things to extreme, at some point, then you end up with the Sephora tweets, right?
Yeah.
Like, they have all these skincare lines are coming out, like what's safe, what's not.
Yeah.
We just don't really have a lot of, we have science behind some of this, but we don't have science behind some of these things.
Right.
It becomes so fad and, all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, this is the new thing.
Right.
But there's no evidence behind it, right? We don't have great studies.
Yes.
And so it sort of becomes an inherent, Wild, Wild West.
Wow. Again. It's the wellness industry, right?
That's right.
Multi-billion-dollar industry. And so is within that is the aesthetics.
But, oh, yeah.
I mean, the cosmetic industry is out of control, too.
Yes.
Somebody just puts a label on it, like so-and-so, whoever they are.
Yeah. They can be a pediatrician.
Yeah.
Doing cosmetics. I mean,
even a big name, Kardashian, their latest products,
right.
Everyone wants them. We don't know, in terms of if it's the safety and efficaciousness of all of these things.
Absolutely. And that just takes time also and money, right?
Like,
the studies are expensive.
Yeah,
it takes a long time to figure out if it was safe or not because we have so little long-term effects of these things that we're doing. And so, yoga, group software, the salmon sperm facial and all those things. And it's like, we really know what that is. What are the problems? We don't know that yet. And I think one of the things that what's interesting to being a plastic surgeon in the United States is a lot of the stuff that we adapt here that are like great new market. I've actually been in these markets for many, many years.
Yeah.
Like breast implants. Like the one that's like now become taking over our market, it's only been here for a year, has been so popular in South America for 15 years.
Nice.
So we have a lot of information already about it. But again, it comes down to cultural differences, ethnicity, genetics, because how that affects them. One woman's pot of gold for her eye cream is another woman's trash, right?
So true.
And because there's a reason for that. If there's hundreds of different
Instagram reels will get you. They're like, this is what you need. And then you're like, okay.
Yes. Why doesn't it work for me that way? This Korean skincare, probably. Why is that not working?
I bought the same at facial thing before.
Right. That's what I'm saying. But that's what you think. You're like, oh, okay, well, this is what I need to do.
Yeah.
And then you're like, wait a minute, I didn't get the same result I was expecting because...
And then you're like, what am I expecting? Am I expecting
a miracle with want everything non-invasive.
Yeah.
But they want the invasive outcomes, right? And so at some point in time, and unfortunately, we just don't have a lot of options to bridge those gaps,
Yeah. Well, okay, so this has been a great conversation. Tell me, what's your vigilante verdict or your hot take you want people to remember? What can we do for prevention? What would you recommend thinking about before you get plastic surgery?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just be honest with yourself and know who you are, right? Knowing what it is that drives you to do these things. And are you going to be okay with an outcome that's not perfect, right? Because perfection is not real. Right? We want perfection.
Yeah, neither are our filters.
That's right. That's the truth. And that's the thing. I think it comes down to, again, knowing yourself and being honest about what it is that you're looking for.
Yeah.
And are you okay if complications happen? Are you going to be mentally able to get through that, or have enough support around you that you could see yourself going through those situations? And of course, we could promise the sun, the moon, and the stars, but is that really what it's going to end up becoming? And are you going to be okay with it if it's not?
Right.
Right? And at what point, where's the end goal? Right?
Yeah.
Because I've operated on people and they're still not happy. And still at that point, you're like, okay, am I ever going to make this person happy?
Right.
What will we do? Right. Exactly. And if you don't really have that, if you know that answer, then I can't fix that either, right? Because plastic surgery doesn't fix emotional issues.
Yeah.
Can obviously bring confidence and all the things that, especially weight loss and all that stuff that's associated with that, maybe plastic is functional things. Okay. So I think, again, plastic surgery really is just a deeply personal journey.
Yeah.
It really is very different depending on the patient. And I sort of am a Sherpa, right? I'm here to guide you through the process and, help you realize, what's a reasonable expectation and not a reasonable expectation. And then we make that decision from there.
I'm not
trying to push people to do certain things where I don't want it.
Right.
But I'm also not going to convince somebody and, if they're really not 100%. You might be 99%.
Yeah.
But, because you're never fully 100% into things sometimes, but
if you're still not quite sure, then I can't help that. Sometimes.
Right.
So we can work through that process together.
Right.
Yeah.
So I joke a lot that I'm a therapist as well, so plastic surgeon,
because
it really is, because when you're doing facial plastics, especially,
it's a shock.
It's a shock because it can change people's faces. It can change you in ways that, like, especially like myoplasties can change your face significantly.
Yeah.
And some people just mentally die. Like, really don't, like, it's hard to really kind of explain that to somebody to the golf.
Yeah. And then you get to get judged after.
Right.
I sometimes feel so sad for the hundreds of celebrities that are going through different
things.
They get so judged about.
And do.
Yeah.
They put their pictures up and, oh, I think they did this and I think they did that.
Yeah.
And I think that that's always the struggle is, like, again, I think people need to do what they feel happy with and what they love and what drives them. And I'm not really going to be here to judge for that. Like, we listen and we don't judge.
Yes,
exactly.
Well, this has been great, Dr. Rice. Dahlia Rice here. She's from Chicago and she is a plastic surgeon. She will put all of her information in the show notes so that you guys can know how to access her. And she's also been on my podcast before. We talked about midlife things, so you can go back and listen to that one. But remember, I'm Dr. Sweener Moth, Dino Girl. We're here between two labia, talking about labias and all the good things. Please like and subscribe to this channel if you have a chance. Leave us a comment. We'll talk about something else next time. And remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me next week.
And a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.